pikes had been accessorized with open-jawed, sharp-fanged skulls of rattlesnakes inserted in the place of human eyes. Demonic visages configured thus bizarrely, with what meaning it was impossible to say. Hendrickson was transfixed by the sight of those evil-eyed totems, the papery bone of long-ago severed serpent heads issuing with silent hisses from skulls unmasked of faces. "Let's go. Let's go," Jane urged, chilled and weary of both body and spirit. "Let's get to the bottom of this place." He didn't respond, but addressed himself as Annabelle had lectured him 40 years earlier, his quiet voice reverberant in the cavernous sarcophagus. "Here's the truth, boy. The one truth. Take or be taken from. Use or be used. Rule or be ruled. Kill or be killed." "Booth, do you hear me?" He said nothing. "Play Manchurian with me."
"Repeat after me, you ignorant little shit. Repeat after me, boy. Repeat after me. Say this. Say, do unto others before they can do unto you. Say it, and mean it. Say it until your throat is raw, until your voice fails."
More adamantly, Jane commanded, "Booth, play Manchurian with me. Now!" After a hesitation, he muttered, "Yes. All right. All right. Yes. You must do what I tell you."
"Yes, mother."
"What did you say?"
"Yes, mother. All right.
Look at me. Booth, look at me now." Hendrickson turned from the display of skulls, his face devoid of expression. As if he saw serpents in her stare, he bowed his head and lowered his eyes.
"Yes, of course. This way. It's not far now."
"Who am I, Booth?"
"Who are you?"
"That's what I asked."
"You're Jane Hawk."
"Why did you call me Mother?"
"Did I?"
"Yes."
"I don't know. You're not her. You're you. I don't know."
She studied him. "Then, lead me to the bottom of this place." A plank bridging a wide cleft, a corridor of dripping stone, umbilicals of light quivering forward along the puddled floor. Two chambers from the bottom, a tumbled collection of small skeletons, discarded as if with contempt, didn't bear consideration, for they were not the remains of some elfin race out of Tolkien, but the bones of children that might have been the offspring of enemies conquered and killed with genocidal intent. Half an hour after they entered the stairhead, they arrived at the bottom of the crooked staircase, where there waited what once must have been a cave that opened onto a last slope leading to the lake, by which this subterranean complex could be accessed. The mouth of the cave had been sealed off with mortared brick, in which stood a steel door like that in the stairhead building. Jane discarded the spray paint and set her light on the floor. Hendrickson focused his beam on the keyway, while she used the lock release gun to disengage the deadbolt. Beyond lay the promised room. 8. Two agents arrive by helicopter. Two more are on their way by ground transport. Jurgen and Dubose leave the airborne pair to deal with the now cooperative local authorities, to clean up the scene and to bag the bodies. The waiting helo, which sits in a corner of the parking lot, will spirit the corpses away. Except for a few locals who witnessed the incident, it will be as though nothing untoward occurred. There will be no press or TV coverage of the shootings in Little Borrego Springs. No one will ever report that Gavin and Jessica Washington were killed here. There will be no autopsy, no coroner's report in any jurisdiction. Another plausible story will be concocted to account for their deaths, which will be framed as a tragic accident. Now, DuBose and Durgan, having administered tragic accidents to quite a few people over the years, set out in the Velociraptor for the address at which they hoped to find Fennel Martin, owner of the Honda sedan with the out-of-date license plates and the long-expired registration. DuBose drives. Just beyond the town limits, Martin's home is a house trailer elevated on a foundation of concrete blocks in the shelter of two big Indian laurels from which shadows yearn eastward. In the shade stands a white-painted metal table and four mismatched patio chairs. A small apron of lawn is long dead, and what grass has not withered away is thatched like a well-worn tatami mat. Under a carport, attached to the trailer, stands a two-door Jeep Wrangler Sport, maybe 6 or 7 years old. Steps formed of concrete blocks serve the door. Durgan and DuBose select their FBI credentials, rather than those of the NSA, because the average citizen doesn't know what the NSA is, but still has some respect for the FBI. DuBose knocks. The man who opens the door must have seen them arrive. He looks past them to the Velociraptor and with a note of wonder asks,
"Man, what is that? Is that a Ford F-150?
"It used to be," says DuBose as he holds up his bureau ID.
"Are you Fennel Martin?"
The guy stares wide-eyed at DuBose's ID, and then he looks at Durgan, and Durgan holds up his ID, and the guy says,
"Really? FBI? Wow. What's this about?"
"Are you Fennel Martin?" DuBose asks again. The man is in his late 30s, lean and tan, with shoulder-length hair and a day's worth of beard, wearing flip-flops and jeans and a Smashing Pumpkins t-shirt. The average guy living on the edge of the law, or a step outside of it, usually is either arrogant and obstinate, making no effort to conceal his contempt, or else goes wobbly in the presence of police and presents himself as meek and compliant in the hope of appearing to be a model citizen. This man's reaction is neither of those. He seems genuinely astonished that FBI agents would appear at his door, perplexed, and just a little bit excited, as if a dull Sunday has suddenly become interesting.
"Yeah, that's me. I'm Fennel."
DuBose says,
"We'd like to ask you a few questions about a car, Mr. Martin." "A car? Sure, man. I'm all about cars. What car is it?" "May we come in, Mr. Martin? This might take a while." "Well, the thing is, the place is kind of a mess," Martin says.
He points at the white table and the folding chairs in the shade of one of the Indian laurels.
"Let's sit there. Can I get you guys a couple beers?" "That's very cordial of you, Mr. Martin, but we can't drink on duty."
DuBose puts away his ID.
"And we'd rather come inside."
To Fennel Martin's surprise, DuBose grabs him by the crotch, squeezing hard, and by the throat, and lifts him an inch off the floor and carries him backward into the house trailer. 9. The steel door at the bottom of the serried caverns opened into a room measuring about 30 by 30 feet. It was furnished as a study or home office in an elegant, soft contemporary style. Immense U-shaped desk and wall of cabinets in matching blonde finished wood. Armchair with a footstool and reading lamp. Sofa. The necessary occasional tables. There was as well an entertainment wall with a music system and a large TV. According to Hendrickson, of the two interior doors, one led to a full bath, the other to a closet. Opposite the steel door by which they entered, another steel door led out of these quarters onto the extensive grounds behind the main house, which overlooked the lake. From the exterior, the stone-walled building was said to look like modest servants' quarters and to match the style of the main house. But in here, there were telltale indications of a secret purpose. The windows were fitted with locking shutters of steel plate that could not have been penetrated by common burglars, and the door to the grounds had a feature that the door to the caverns did not, Three 4-inch wide steel bars that extruded from the jamb across the width of the door when the deadbolt was engaged from outside. The door featured no obvious escutcheon or keyway. It was locked and unlocked only by a keypad on this side and another on the exterior wall. All this was as Hendrickson had told her after she injected him in Gilberto's kitchen, and as he had confirmed after the nanomachine control had assembled.
"Let's do this fast," she said. "Get me those DVDs."
Hendrickson had said there was an alarm system for the main house, but none here. He insisted that Annabelle would not want police responding to any attempted break-in of this building. Nevertheless, Jane wanted to be done and gone in 5 minutes. Initially, she had intended to take Hendrickson with her, to use him as an example of nanoweb control, to convince some uncorrupted authority, if she could find one, of the truth of this technology. But his psychological deterioration, which seemed to be continuing, made that plan untenable. She would have to leave him here. Jane followed him into the large bathroom, which was entirely clad in honey-colored marble, ceiling, walls, floor, shower stall. The tub and sink were carved from blocks of the same material, and all the fixtures were gold-plated. Annabelle had quarters in the main house, but when she wanted a bathroom here, it must be exquisitely appointed, the color of honey, for the queen bee. Hendrickson pressed on the fluted, gilded frame of the mirror above the sink, releasing a touch latch, and the mirror swung like a door. Within were the four shelves of a medicine cabinet, stocked with the usual items. When he pulled on the second and third shelves simultaneously, the interior of the cabinet came forward on rails, revealing a space beyond. From that hidden compartment, he withdrew a rectangular plastic box and handed it to her. As Hendrickson rolled the interior of the cabinet back into place and closed the mirrored door, Jane flipped up the lid on the plastic box. Within were 16 DVDs in cardboard sleeves. On each sleeve, a first name had been printed with a black felt-tip pen. She said, "Your father's name was
Stafford. Stafford Eugene Hendrickson."
In the study again, she found the DVD marked Stafford. She put the box on the desk. She hesitated to give the disc to Hendrickson. "You've really seen this?" His face was slack and his voice without color, as though he had traveled into some gray kingdom of the soul where he could no longer feel anything strongly.
"Of course. Many times. We watched it together many times, Mother. Back then it was on videotape. We didn't have DVDs then, did we? You had to transfer them to DVD."
She needed to be sure these discs contained what he'd said they did. She gave the DVD of his father to him. "Play this for me."
"Yes. All right."
He took it to the entertainment center. In the years during which Jane had worked with the Bureau's Behavioral Analysis Units 3 and 4, she had been assigned to cases involving serial killers. When she had tracked their squamous kind to the snake holes they called home, as always she did, she had seen things that could never be purged from memory, that returned to her on sleepless nights. A firm faith in the rightness of this made world and in the promise of the human heart was required to look upon the works of those supremely evil individuals without losing hope for humanity in its entirety. That faith had sometimes been bruised, but never broken. Yet she steeled herself for what would appear on this large screen television. She intended to watch only enough of it to confirm that Hendrickson's description of it was accurate. 10. When Jurgen follows Dubose and the wheezing Fennel Martin into the house trailer, he discovers why their host prefers to sit at the table in the yard to answer questions. The girl might be 30, an ash blonde cutie. Their explosive entrance surprises her. She thrusts up from the sofa, hastily buttoning her open blouse, though not hastily enough that Jurgen has no chance to admire the fullness of her figure. Approaching her, smiling in a friendly sort of way, he says, "What's your name, dear?"
"Who are you? What are you doing to him? You've hurt him!"
Jurgen flashes his bureau ID, but the girl doesn't appear to be reassured by it. Still smiling, he says, "He'll be okay. That's nothing. Things happen, that's all. Tell me your name, dear."
"Ginger."
"Ginger, can you show me where the bathroom is, please?"
"Why?"
"I want you to stay in the bathroom while we're having a chat with Mr. Martin. But I need to be sure there's no window big enough for you to climb out."
"There isn't."
"It's not that I don't believe you, Ginger. I do believe you, but I need to see for myself. It's the way I was trained. We go through a lot of training in the FBI. I'm just following protocol. You understand?"
"No. I guess. Yeah."
"So let's go see the bathroom." The window is very small and near the ceiling. He puts down the lid of the toilet and gestures for her to sit there. "Where's your phone, Ginger?"
"In my purse. On the table by the sofa."
"Good. You wouldn't want to be calling anyone. Just wait here, and we'll be gone in no time." She is trembling.
"I'll wait. I'm okay with waiting."
Jurgen steps into the hallway, looks back at her. "Fennel's not going to be ready for sex, after all. But when we're gone, you can play cards or something." Jurgen closes the door and returns to the living room, where the fan of the Smashing Pumpkins is sitting in an armchair. Fennel's tan now has a gray undertone. Sweat slicks his face, jewels his eyebrows. With his right hand, he gently cups his crotch. Dubose has moved a side chair to sit in front of their host. Jurgen perches on the edge of the sofa. Dubose says,
"Fennel, we need some truth. And we need it fast."
Fennel sounds 13 when he says,
"You aren't FBI." "What I don't need," Dubose explains, "is your stupid opinions and commentary. I'll ask questions, you'll answer them, and we'll be on our way. Earlier, you said, I'm all about cars, which means... I'm a mechanic. I have a place in town. It's not much, but... I stay busy." "You take cash to fake smog checks so dirty cars can pass inspection?" "What? Shit, no. I have a business license to protect." "You build secret compartments in the bodywork so some asshole can run 50 kilos of heroin in from Mexico?"
Fennel glances at Jurgen.
"I think maybe I need an attorney." "Don't answer my questions," Dubose explains, "and what you'll need is a testicle transplant. Before you bullshit me, consider maybe I already know the truth."
The mechanic is too frightened to lie, but afraid that honesty will not avail him.
"I run a clean business, man. I swear."
Dubose frowns and bites his lower lip as if he's disappointed in Fennel.
"You once owned a green Honda. What happened to it?"
Fennel is surprised it's about this, and maybe alarmed.
"I sold her. She was cheap, ran good, but she was the opposite of sexy." "When was that?" "I don't know, exactly. Like, maybe 6 years ago?" "Who'd you sell it to?" "This guy? Some guy?" "Don't remember his name?" "No. Not after so long." "What did he look like?" "He was Asian." "What Asian? Chinese, Japanese, Korean?" "I don't know. How would I know?" "You put an ad in the paper? On some internet site?" "No. Just a sign outside my shop." "What's your bank?" "Bank? Wells Fargo. What's my bank matter?" "I need the account number. and the amount of the check.
Fennel is sweating anew.
His bank wasn't the same as mine. You remember that, do you? Doesn't matter. We can track it from bank to bank. What was the amount of the check?
Fennel looks around as if he's lost, as if he doesn't recognize his own living room.
After 6 years, it comes back to bite me? 6 years? This totally sucks.
11. They stood before the large LED television screen. Hendrickson pushed play and handed the remote to Jane. In silence, the camera moved past torches standing tall in oil drums filled with sand, serpentine coils of dark smoke rising toward vent holes in the ceiling, past the corrugated walls of the Quonset hut, firelight rippling with the contours of the metal, illuminating goggle-eyed lizards in vertical pursuit of cockroaches that could not outrun the spooling tongues. Racks of candles, hundreds of thick candles, mostly black and red, but here a cluster of canary yellow, the fluttering flames patterning everything around them with faux butterflies and causing the very air to glow as in a furnace. Voodoo waves on the concrete floor, intricate patterns drawn with wheat flour and cornmeal and ashes and red brick dust, representing astral forces here attendant. The scene had an inauthentic quality, as if it had been staged in imitation of true voodoo, to establish a narrative explaining the murder to come. This suspicion was confirmed when four men entered, dressed not in what voodoo priests would wear, but clad in black and hooded to maintain anonymity. At the center of all, a pale and naked man lay chained to a sacrificial altar formed by three concentric circles of stepped stone around a center post carved as a pair of twining snakes. Speaking to himself, as Annabel had spoken to him, Hendrickson said,
"There he is, the gutless wonder, the worthless piece of shit who fathered you. You'll hear him beg. You'll hear him beg me. You listen to him beg, boy, and learn never to beg for anything from anyone. See here what begging gets you."
The camera panned across a battalion of conical blue and green drums, and as it returned to the naked man, the silence gave way to the rhythmic beating of the drums, though neither the instruments nor those who played them were shown again. Stafford Hendrickson did indeed beg Annabel by name, his pleas desperate, and then hysterical, as the four black-garbed executioners began to effect a prolonged act of murder. Tourniquets to stem the bleeding, preventing the victim's quick demise. A razor-sharp machete. They began with his right hand. Jane used the remote, and the screen went blank. Booth Hendrickson said,
"Your daddy was a pencil-neck history geek. He loved the past in all its barbaric splendor. He loved his crooked staircase, his private archaeological treasure. I wouldn't give him the satisfaction of adding any part of his body to that collection. They left him to the Jamaican lizards and cockroaches until the police found the worthless bastard."
12. Although Carter Jurgen wants a turn driving the Velociraptor, and although there are occasions when his partner appalls him, he has to admit there are also times when he greatly enjoys watching Radley DuBose at work, as now. In numerous subtle ways, the big man builds an air of menace, akin to how a thunderstorm builds a charge leading up to that sudden first flash of lightning. Poor Fennel Martin. The mechanic is profoundly intimidated. DuBose gets up from his chair and paces the small living room, seeming even bigger than usual by comparison with the humble space he occupies, the floor creaking under him.
"When a car is sold in California, the seller is required by law to file a notice of transfer and release of liability with the DMV, providing, among other things, the new owner's name.
You never did that, Mr. Martin.
He didn't want me to. Part of the deal was I wouldn't file a notice of transfer.
You're talking now of the mysterious Asian buyer, who never filed for a new registration either.
He was an Asian guy. I wasn't lying about that.
What was his name, Mr. Martin?
He never gave me a name. He didn't even speak English.
DuBose stopped pacing and turned and stared down at Fennel.
It's true, the mechanic insists. He had it all typed out.
Had what typed out?
The deal he wanted to make for the Honda, the terms.
He couldn't speak English, but he could type it.
Somebody typed it for him. Whoever was really buying the car. I don't know who, I really don't.
So somebody wanted a car that couldn't be traced back to him. Didn't you worry about liability, Mr. Martin? Like if they used the car in a bank robbery?
He wouldn't do that. He was a very nice man. Very respectful.
Who was?
The Asian guy.
But he wasn't the actual buyer. The actual buyer could have been some damn terrorist going to use it as a car bomb.
The mechanic bends forward in the armchair, hands on his thighs, head between his knees, as if nauseated and about to spew.
It wasn't used as a car bomb, DuBose says.
Fennel shudders with relief.
But we damn well have to find whoever bought it, and find him fast. What aren't you telling me, Mr. Martin? There needs to be one more piece to this story of yours, if it's to make sense.
In his misery, Fennel Martin speaks to the floor between his feet.
You know what it is.
I know what it has to be, but I need to hear it.
The guy comes to me with the terms typed out and a sort of briefcase, full of cash. The Honda's 6 years old then. It's got some serious miles on it. Maybe it's worth 6,000. There's 60,000 in the bag.
Tax-free, DuBose says.
Well, shit. I guess not now.
After a silence looming over Fennel, DuBose says,
So you figured, if the car was used for a crime, then you'd act surprised to find it missing, say it was stolen.
Seemed like it would work. I really needed the money.
Did you ever see anyone driving that car around town?
Not in years. Two, maybe three times back then I saw it parked. Never saw anyone with it. I didn't want to see anyone. I didn't want to know who or why.
You didn't want to risk him asking for his money back.
The mechanic says nothing.
Look at me, Mr. Martin.
The mechanic doesn't raise his head.
I don't want to.
Look at me.
You'll hurt me.
Even worse if you don't look at me.
Reluctantly, Fennel Martin turns his head, looks up, terrified. DuBose says,
I'm in a mood to bust your balls. I mean that literally. You made me pull the details out of you one by one, so now you better hope there's something useful you've not yet told me. Because if there isn't, you'll be useless to women when I'm done with you.
Fennel Martin is a poster boy for pathos.
There isn't anything more. I'm not hiding anything more. There's nothing more.
There better be.
But there isn't.
Get up, Mr. Martin.
I can't. Get up. Maybe
I'm waiting.
Maybe one thing.
It was kind of funny. Those typed up deal terms, they were done as bullet points. And after each bullet point, whoever he was, he typed please and thank you. Like it said, purchase price will be $60,000, please and thank you. And neither of us will report the sale, please and thank you.
DuBose stares down at him with contempt, and after a long silence, wonders,
What am I supposed to do with that idiot tidbit? It's all I have. I didn't even know I had that. Did you save that paper you were given? No.
After another silence, during which the mechanic looks as if he will die from suspense, Dubose says,
Hell. You're not worth the effort.
He walks out of the trailer. 13. It was one thing to see the aftermath of such brutality, another thing altogether to watch even a minute of it in progress. Sickened, Jane returned the DVD to its cardboard sleeve and then put it in the plastic box with the 15 others. She trusted Booth Hendrickson's word that two discs featured other of Annabelle's divorced husbands. One would show he who supposedly hung himself with a noose of barbed wire, except that he begged for his life before hooded men did the hanging for him. And perhaps it was the same hooded men, well paid and eager to accommodate, who videoed the other husband, pleading for mercy before they set the house on fire, or in fact, set him on fire and let him carry the flames through the house. Among the other DVDs were more recent videos that recorded the injection and enslavement of a United States senator, a governor who was thought to have a future in national politics, a Supreme Court justice, the president of a major television network, the publisher of a highly respected magazine of opinion, and others who were now adjusted people. Annabelle nurtured a particular animus against each. She wanted videos of their conversion for the historical record and for her own entertainment. With this evidence, and all the additional names and details that Hendrickson had revealed, Jane would find a way to bring the Techno-Arcadians to ruin, every last one of them. As she was putting the plastic container in her tote bag, the TV came on. The screen filled with the face of Annabelle Claridge, at 75, still beautiful. An imperious beauty. High cheekbones, chiseled features, hair, thick and glossy, faded from black to a lustrous silver rather than white. Her eyes were as bright blue as Jane's, as blue as Petra Quist's eyes and the eyes of Simon's wives. A more fierce blue, perhaps, but lacking any glint of madness. Hendrickson stood before the TV, zombified, as Jane had left him. He had apparently inserted another DVD. But then, Annabelle said,
Booth, what are you doing there? What stupid thing have you allowed to happen?
I'm sorry, Mother. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. She made me do it.
Annabelle was broadcasting live, perhaps via Skype. Behind her, a window. Beyond the window, a palm tree. The estate in La Jolla. In the grip of morbid fascination, Jane had taken a couple steps away from the desk and had evidently come into the range of the camera built into the TV. The matriarch's eyes turned to her.
My son isn't a weakling like his worthless father. My son is strong. How did you break him so fast?
Evidently, when Hendrickson accessed the secret space behind the medicine cabinet, he'd triggered an alarm that was phoned not to the police, but to Annabelle in faraway La Jolla. The woman's gaze shifted from Jane to her son.
Booth, take no chances. Big firepower. Kill her.
He turned away from the TV, from Jane, and started across the room toward the closet door. Jane said,
Booth, play Manchurian with me.
The gasp of shock from Annabelle was proof enough that no one had known Jane had acquired ampules of the control mechanism when she'd been in Bertold Schenick's house in Napa Valley weeks earlier.
Play Manchurian with me, Jane repeated.
Again, he failed to respond as he worked the lever handle on the closet door. Jane drew her heckler and fired twice as he darted into the closet. The first round drilling the jam and showering him with splinters, the second passing through the diminishing gap between the jam and the closing door, which slammed shut.
You ignorant skank.
Annabelle's hatred was in fact rancor. The rancidity of mind and heart evolved from cherished malignity that had been long souring, festering, now virulent and implacable. Her venomous rancor had the power to transmogrify her face from that of an elegantly aging grande dame out of the pages of Town and Country into a grotesque countenance, both terrifying and beautiful, as might be the face of a fallen angel enraptured by the power to do evil.
You foolish little twat. Your control is layered over the control that I injected a month ago.
Mine rules over yours.
He's mine, and he always will be.
No wonder he had been disintegrating psychologically. One web was woven across the other, his skull crowded with nanostructures, his free will long extinguished. Big firepower. He was getting a fully automatic weapon, maybe an automatic shotgun with an extended magazine. Annabelle, in distant La Jolla, was a threat for another day. Booth was now. One way out. Jane holstered the pistol, grabbed the tote, and rushed to the door by which they had entered. As she yanked open the steel slab, a weapon spoke repeatedly inside the closet. A volley of high-powered rounds drilled the door, cracked and shrieked into furniture behind her. She crossed the threshold, snatched her flashlight from the floor where she had left it, switched it on, and hurried up a ramp of stone into a higher chamber. The steel door closed with a crash that echoed dire warnings through this nautilus of stone. 14. Wearing sunglasses against the nuclear glare of the desert sun, cruising the town, such as it is, in the Velociraptor, looking for he knows not what, bringing to bear all the pathetic intellectual faculties he possesses and what little knowledge Princeton will have bothered to impart, DuBose drives. Riding shotgun, wearing sunglasses, more concerned about their situation than he cares to admit, Carter Jurgen says, "We never did get lunch. Where should we have dinner? At the quaint Mexican bar and grill, the taco house, a vending machine at some tacky motel?"
"If he sold it to someone who lived in town," DuBose says, "then he would have seen the Honda more than twice over the years."
"Possibly," Jurgen acknowledges.
"Definitely. Someone local bought it, but not someone in town. Someone willing and able to pay a boatload of money to avoid having a car registered in his name."
"I wouldn't call $60,000 a boatload."
"It was a boatload to Fennel Martin."
"We never did ask him what's with the name Fennel."
"I did, while you were putting Ginger in the toilet."
Jurgen winced.
"Bathroom." "His mother, she's big into herbal medicine, says eat enough fennel every day, you add 20 years to the average lifespan. So she doesn't just feed it to him, she names him for it."
"How old is his mother?"
"She died when she was 32.
"What we're going to do is we're going to cruise around the valley while we have a few hours of light. Have a look."
"Look for what?"
"Something.
Anything. You got an iPhone picture of the Honda?"
"Yes."
"We'll show it to some people we see here and there. Maybe one of them will know it. For a Honda, it's a peculiar shade of green."
This is too much for Jurgen, this claim of Sherlockian mastery of esoteric detail. "You know 12-year-old Honda colors?"
"I love Hondas. My first car was a Honda."
DuBose still seems as if he stepped out of a comic book, but the difference this time is that Carter Jurgen is beginning to feel as though he's losing substance from association with this hulk and will wind up himself, like a fumbling detective in some Saturday morning TV cartoon show. 15. In the reeling and seesawing beam, the smooth wet flowstone seeming to throb like the peristalsis of some monstrous esophagus trying to swallow her as she struggled upward. Climbing, open-mouthed, to minimize the gasp and wheeze of respiration, listening intently for sounds of pursuit, which will precede the gunfire. Out of the cave that adjoined the room where the face of Annabelle floated on the LED screen, through the first of the caverns, Jane's quick footsteps were soft on dry stone, squelching on the wet. She came next into the chamber where, on both sides, the skeletons of children were heaped in a timeless testament to hate and cruelty. The path through that boneyard of innocence brought her to a lich gate, formed from slabs of stone tumbled in one or more ancient quakes. Three passages provided a choice. As she took the one marked by a white arrow of paint, from below came the thunder of the steel door slamming shut, doomful echoes ringing off the stone to all sides of her. He was in the crooked staircase and climbing. Bite on the fear. There was a boy to live for. Pressing forward, she passed through a corridor of sweating stone, droplets of water falling cold on her face, and in the next cavern arrived at a plank that bridged a fissure perhaps more than 7 feet wide. When she reached the farther side of the bridge, she put her tote down and probed the cleft with her light. It was about 30 feet deep, with sloped walls that would allow a swift and safe descent of the farther side and a clamorous ascent of this nearer face. He would need a few minutes to transit that territory. Precious time in which she could get a safer distance ahead of him. She put the flashlight on the floor, the beam fanning across the stone to the crude bridge. She knelt and lifted her end of the plank out of the notch in which it rested and pulled hard, dragging it from the other notch on the farther side. The heavy length of wood slipped from her hands, clattering into the cleft, knocking leaden bell sounds from the walls of stone. On her feet again, she snatched up the tote with its precious evidence, plucked the flashlight from the floor, and switched it off. She looked back toward the dripping corridor, to the lich gate at the farther end of it, beyond which light swept back and forth in the tomb of the innocents. Now that Hendrickson had entered the labyrinth, he was coming faster than she had hoped, with whatever fully automatic weapon he possessed. Clicking on the light, she hurried through the remainder of the cavern. She ascended a narrow flight of low and uneven steps, across one of which slithered three translucent alabaster insects, of a kind she had never seen before, each the size of her thumb. The beam of light revealing their inner organs like miniature voodoo waves in photo negative. She cautioned herself that, although haste was essential, she couldn't afford to trip and fall. She would never escape this preview of damnation with a broken leg. Not halfway across the upper room, Jane heard Hendrickson in the lower chamber, beyond the stepped passage. He shouted to her, boasting like a boy,
"I can jump! I don't need a plank. I can jump that far easy. I can jump."
She dared not wait to hear him screaming in pain from the bottom of the fissure. Perhaps he could have jumped across the gap 40 years earlier as a spry and limber boy, but though he might now be regressing into some adolescent mental state, he was nonetheless a man in his late 40s with less athletic ability than in his youth. Praying for his fall, she hurried on and was spurred faster when, instead of a scream of agony, he let loose a cry of triumph at having cleared the wide fissure without any need of a bridge. The exit passage from the current cavern angled sharply to the right. She ducked into it. She switched off her light and tucked it under her belt, dropped the tote, drew the heckler, turned to the room that she'd just left. She would kill him when he came off the steps where the ghostly insects had crossed her path. The muzzle flash of the heckler would reveal her position, but he would be wounded or dead before he could return fire. Jane heard him on those stairs, but there was no jiggling light by which to measure his ascent. He was coming in the dark. Suppose he had regressed to adolescence or childhood. If so, then in his diminished state, perhaps he'd found the fear-etched memory of the architecture of this stone hive, perfected through thousands of hours of blind exploration, and now had no more need of light than did the sightless insects on the stairs. Although her heart knocked at a gallop, the pistol felt steady in her two-hand grip, and all she needed to do was listen for the change in his breathing and the difference in his footfalls when he topped the stairs. He would be directly in front of her, 30 feet away. She wouldn't be able to put every round in the body core, but four shots squeezed off in quick succession would result in at least a couple hits, certainly one of which would wound him badly, if not kill him. absolute darkness, without a single point of light, with no varying shades of black to give perspective, was disorienting. She held her stance and didn't let the gun drift to one side or the other. He needed less than a minute to climb the steps, but time seemed attenuated in this total eclipse. She held her breath, the better to hear when he transitioned from the stairs. Suddenly, there was only silence. Case after case, in the bureau, and now gone rogue from it. She survived because of training and intuition. If she'd had to choose between one or the other, she would have foregone training to rely on intuition. The still, small voice that speaks out of your bone and blood and muscle. It spoke to her now, and she knew that Hendrickson anticipated a trap. He'd come off the stairs with his breath held, careful to make no sound in his final few steps. He would start moving sideways around the chamber that lay between them, out of her blind line of fire. Hoping she had been quick enough to intuit his intent, she didn't hesitate to squeeze off shots, although just two, not daring to expose herself through twice that many. An extra 2 seconds might be the difference between life and death. As she juked back into the passageway, he fired a burst at her muzzle flash, maybe 6 rounds. Stone cracked, bullets ricocheted with thin banshee shrieks, and even through the roar, she heard the distinct and mortal whistle of a round or two passing through the opening where she had stood. She had to keep him guessing for 10 seconds, 15. If she dared the flashlight, he'd follow, hose the passageway, and take her down, either with a direct hit or a couple bank shots. She plucked the tote off the floor, left the flash tucked in her waistband, moving into the pitch-black passageway. She knew that in 12 or 15 feet it curved to the left, a ramp of flowstone, and she thought it lacked steps all the way to the top, although her memory was but a crude sketch compared to the mental blueprints he could consult. 16. They were hours late. Travis didn't want to believe anything bad had happened to them, but they were very late. Although he was supposed to stay away from the windows, he now stood in the living room, staring out at the highway, hoping to see the green car drive up to this little blue house, everyone safe and happy after all. Cars passed now and then, but never the right one. The day someone killed his dad, he'd been playing at a friend's house, staying overnight. He hadn't heard about his dad until the next day. He didn't want to hear about Uncle Gavin and Aunt Jessie later. He wanted them to come home. He asked God to get them home. The dogs were restless. Duke and Queenie roamed the house, not just on patrol, but as if looking for something. Looking for Gavin and Jessie, just like Travis was. Gavin and Jessie were supposed to be there. The dogs knew Gavin and Jessie were supposed to be there, just like Travis knew. It was time to feed the dogs. There was kibble, brought from home, with biscuit treats and collars and leashes and blue poop bags. He knew how to measure the kibble. Soon he would have to give them kibble and leash them and take them outside. He didn't want to take them outside. For one thing, he wasn't supposed to leave the house. Don't answer the door, don't go near the windows, don't leave the house. Those were the rules. His mom said the best chance anyone had for a good and happy life was to play by the rules. For another thing, he was afraid if he broke the rule about not leaving the house, he would jinx Gavin and Jessie. Then maybe they would never come back. Duke came to his side and stood looking out at the palm tree shadows stretching long, the sunshine, the highway. The dog made a crying sound. 17. The curving ramp of flowstone ascended without steps. Although Jane repeatedly misjudged the curve, bumping against the walls, she made it to the top, where she stood for a moment, listening to the hush below. He seemed hesitant to follow closely, as if he too feared being hosed in those confines. Keep moving. Plan the action and commit. Stalking and being stalked, You're more likely to die from lack of commitment than from taking action. Because she had one more task than she had hands, she holstered the pistol. She carried the tote in her left hand, the flashlight now in her right, two fingers across the lens to damp the beam, so the glow might not be as easily seen around corners or from another room. Sideways through a narrow passage, as if she were a fencer, the light her foil. Into a chamber with an open center, surrounded by a peristyle of columns formed by stalactites meeting stalagmites. The atmosphere, that of a temple, as if some subterranean congregation of mutant form gathered here according to a netherworld calendar to worship gods unknown. Three passageways led out, and she took the one marked by a white arrow of paint, glancing back frequently. She was like Jonah in the belly of the whale, although if this had been a leviathan, it would have lived hundreds of millions of years ago in a sea that had receded, its massive corpus fossilized, its endless bowels turned to stone. They had taken half an hour to descend from the stairhead, but ascent would take longer. She hoped that by moving faster than might seem prudent, she would not only put distance between herself and Hendrickson in his blind pursuit, but also make her way to the surface in as little as 40 minutes. She found herself holding her breath when she didn't intend to hold it, and her mouth repeatedly filled with saliva, perhaps ruled by a subconscious fear that the sound of swallowing would be enough to bring him down on her. In the first room of skulls, with their lethal pikes of chert and obsidian, with their fanged and yawning eyes, the deep stillness behind Jane suddenly meant to her not that Hendrickson was creeping cat quiet, but that he was no longer following in her wake. Not that he was shot and dead, not that he was incapacitated by injury, not that he had descended into some madness in which he could not function. He was no longer following her, because he was taking another route known only to him, and would be waiting for her someplace ahead. She halted, with hundreds of eyeless sockets gazing at her from their ledges, with hundreds of humorless smiles turned upon her. No. Bite on the fear. She knew what to do. There was death everywhere in this place, yes, but there was death everywhere in the world above as well. Between the idea and the reality, between the motion and the act, falls the shadow. Even in the valley of the shadow of death, keep moving. Plan the action and commit. Hesitation was lethal. 18. On this bright Sunday afternoon in rural Borrego Valley, the white-clabbered church with the white-shingled steeple seems luminous in the fierce desert sun, as if it takes the hard light into itself and softens it and gives it back in a form that is easier on the eyes. It reminds Carter Jurgen of those carefully detailed miniature buildings that people use to create precious little villages in Christmas displays through which scale model electric trains go clickety-clickety-clickety in tedious circles. A couple dozen vehicles are parked in front of the place, and newly arrived people are going not into the church but around the side of it to join others gathered in a bosque of trees under which stand maybe a dozen long picnic tables. Dubose pulls the velociraptor to the side of the road and studies the scene for a moment.
What's all this about?
It's Sunday, says Jurgen.
But it's not Sunday morning.
Some of the new arrivals are carrying baskets.
Baskets of what?
Maybe food, Jurgen suggests. Maybe later they're going to have Sunday supper together. After consideration, Dubose says,
I don't think I like this.
Jurgen agrees. Dull as bingo night in an old folks' home, but we can show the Honda photo to a lot of people in a few minutes. Dubose glowers in thought.
All right, but let's get the hell in and out.
He drives into the church lot and parks. As they're walking across the blacktop, Jurgen glances back at the velociraptor. It looks like some magnificent machine predator, that when no one is looking will become animate and eat all the crappy little vehicles surrounding it. As they reach the corner of the church, the gleeful squeals of children rise in a raucous chorus and Dubose halts.
Oh, shit.
Kids tend to want to climb in the giant's lap and pull his ears and make a honking noise when they pinch his nose. He's like a big shaggy dog to them. 10 minutes, Jurgen promises. They follow a brick walkway through a landscape of pebbles and cactuses and silver dollar plants and various weird succulents to the cluster of 9 big trees that shade the picnic area. None of the younger children are in the bosque, where the adults are mingling. A separate rubber-floored playground features a jungle gym, a tube slide, swings, and other attractions that Jurgen thought had gone extinct with the invention of the Game Boy. Screaming kids are running, jumping, sliding, swinging, and slashing at one another with foam rubber swords.
Son of a bitch,
Dubose mutters, but he doesn't bolt. Jurgen asks a woman in a flowered muumuu if the minister is in attendance, and she points to a man of about 30 who is standing 2 trees away from them, chatting with parishioners. Pastor Milo, she says. Pastor Milo has a shaved head and an athletic physique. He wears sneakers, white jeans, a blue Hawaiian shirt, and an earring that is a dangling cross, remembering Reverend Gordon M. Gordon of the Mission of Light Church. Jurgen whispers to Dubose, try not to shoot this one. 19. The tote slung over her left shoulder, a flashlight in her left hand now, 2 fingers still over the lens to allow only the minimum of necessary light, the Heckler and Koch in her right hand, no hope of doing this with a 2-hand grip. All 5 senses enhanced by adrenaline and fear, hyper-acute. The darkness layered with moving shadows, moving not because something living shared the immediate space, moving because the light she carried briefly enlivened phantoms as she progressed. The whisper of her breathing. Otherwise, no sounds except the slow dripping of water at sundry places in the gloom, ticking like clocks that had marked the years in their millions. The scent of wet stone, of her own fear sweat. How very like a dream it often was, these minutes before a final accounting, when it came down to kill or be killed, and this time more than ever dreamlike. Caverns flowing for the most part in soft folds, as if the walls continuously melt and reform around her. The massive tusks and skulls of mastodons materializing like some gene-stored memory of another incarnation many lives before this one. Here, again, the regiments of skeletal hands in bony gesture, once sheathed in flesh and occupied with work, with play, with making love, with making war. And in every dream, somewhere a beast prowled, human or not, the human kind more terrifying than others. Only the human monster knew beauty and rejected it, knew truth and disdained it, knew peace and did not prefer it, unlike the tiger and the wolf who knew not. This time, it was a boy, a lost boy in spite of the almost 5 decades he'd lived and sought his way, now crawling this underworld, more confident in the blinding dark than in the light. If he would kill her because he'd been told to kill her, he might kill her with particular savagery also, because in his dementia he confused her with the hated mother who had molded him from boy into beast. When Jane reached the end of the display of hands, she paused in a kind of vestibule between caverns. Just before the terminus of this small connecting chamber lay a generous passageway to the right and a narrower one to the left, and directly forward a room awaited without grisly ornamentation. She was only a couple levels below the stairhead. Easing forward, she lifted the 2 shading fingers from the lens, and the light lanced the wide corridor to the right, steps zigzagging down, walls dissolving away into the dark. The narrower passage to the left led straight away, without steps, and continuing beyond the reach of the beam. She covered the lens again and stood listening. From the cavern directly ahead came not the drip of water, but a drizzling sound. She recalled a flute.